solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You're not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as the trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the first conversation in 2018 at the Play to Potential Podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm an executive coach and I work with leaders and organizations play to their potential by engaging with them during periods of high-stakes transition, whether it's personal or organizational. You could visit transitioninsight.com for more details. If you're new to the podcast and want to get a sense of the nature of content that's covered here, you might want to go to YouTube and type Play to Potential, highlights from 2017. There I've tried to capture the key takeaways from my various conversations last year with leaders across disciplines, from people such as Zia Modi, Nanda Nilekani, Vishwanathan Anand, Vijay Amritraj, Avnish Bajaj, Vinita Bali, and more. My guest this time is Meher Padamji, chairman of Thermax Limited. In our conversation, she spoke about her formative years and how that shaped her, how she and her mother dealt with the twin shocks of her father and brother passing away in quick succession, the role music plays in her life, and how it impacts her leadership, her perspectives on philanthropy, women leadership, and more. Just a quick note on how you could access the content at playtopotential.com. You could either listen in to the full conversation or a particular nugget, or if you're interested in multiple perspectives that are curated by key themes, you could visit the curated playlists section in the website. Without further ado, over to the conversation with Meher. Meher, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Maybe a good place to start is if you could talk a little bit about what all you do today. But more importantly, I'm curious about how people organize their time. So if you looked at your pie chart of time, what all do you do? And talk to us a little bit about why you do what you do.
You're talking to someone who's not a great keeper of time. but I'll tell you. I mean, I'm involved in several different projects apart from Thermax.
Right.
So Thermax is obviously the core.
Right.
But ever since I became non-executive, I do have time on my hands to do other things.
Right.
And I'm quite passionate about education. Mm-hmm. So I do spend a lot of my time in the education field mm-hmm. through a few NGOs that we support.
Right.
The second is a little bit on green climate change. Mm-hmm. So I'm on the board of another NGO.
Right.
And the third would be my music. So I've been singing for the last 20 years. Prior to that, I played the piano.
Wow.
So just in terms of three
big buckets.
Buckets, yeah, other than Thermax. And of course, my personal time with the family and friends and stuff like that. And a little bit in terms of trying to now look at health as well. Mm. So, which I think is an important piece.
And in terms of you saying your health or investing in health as a cause?
No, in my health.
Your health.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. And has this sort of portfolio shifted significantly over time? Let's say if you looked at this 10 years back versus now, is that a big shift?
No, I would say over 10 years, probably the shift is more or less, I mean, the trend is more or less the same.
Right.
Maybe give or take within this. Mm. But otherwise, the buckets sort of remained more or less the same.
Understood.
Over the last 10 years. Yeah.
Understood. And just rewinding the clock, Meher, the other piece I'm curious about when I talk to people is how we get shaped by our formative years.
Mm.
Again, if you had to reflect on your growing up years, are there any themes around the context in which you grew up, where what got shaped there still form a core part of who you are today?
I think so, very much so. I think basically both my brother and I were treated very equally.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing about you being a girl, you mm-hmm. need to do certain things, especially mm-hmm. in the Indian context,
right.
that a girl does. My parents believed very strongly in the value of education. And they felt that that is the only gift that they can give their children, after which it's up to them to do what they do with it. And so they invested in education, both for Kurush and me, very equally. I was interested in the sciences and I wanted to be an engineer. And I was encouraged to do that. Kurush, when he was very little, was very interested in knitting and in cooking. And my mom would encourage him to come into the kitchen and help her and whatever. You know, I was not at all interested in cooking and I still am not. And that was fine too. So it was never sort of that you had to do what a woman ought to do.
So gender agnostic.
Totally gender agnostic, yeah. My grandmother, on the other hand, was slightly different. My father's mother very, very much believed that the best, if there was one chicken piece left over from lunch, that would go to her grandson when he came back from school. She had a particular ring, which was one of my favorites. But she said, sorry, that will only go to my grandson. So, I mean, but I think everybody is molded by their formative years and the way they've grown up. So she brought that to the table. On the other hand, my mother's mother was very pro me. So in some ways, it balanced out. So another thing I think that that really shaped me as I am today is this whole idea of being privileged and giving, giving back. And it, I think my mom being a social worker by training, it always helped because she was always involved in some form of social work or the other. She picked up two boys from the street and brought them home to stay with us and tried an experiment to see whether she could really lift them off the street, start sending them to a school and look after them. Unfortunately, it didn't work. After a week, they both went back to the streets and said that our freedom is far more important to us than being in this Bhoot Bangla.
Interesting.
So I've always, we went to Mother Teresa's home with her. So we always did something or the other. We had two of our friends who grew up together, a girl and boy. And we grew up together in each other's homes. So we would put up plays every, maybe twice a year, invite our parents and their friends and bake some cookies, sell it to them, get tickets, get them to buy tickets. And then we would give that money to Mother Teresa's home.
Interesting.
So that kind of a thing started from the time that I was very, very little. So I think that sort of stayed with me and to where I am today.
Very interesting. And just talking about, let's say, generational transition, one of the things I'm curious about is, especially when we take Anuaga, your mom, and you, What are the lessons to be learned from ensuring that this happens well in a context where you are also operating in a company which is professionally run? Talk to us a little bit about what's been your journey and what have been the lessons from the journey in getting the transition right.
Okay, so let me start in terms of saying that the way I joined the company was as an engineer trainee, and I think that helped me. Having said that, if I had to do it differently for my children, I would say it's nice to be able to have had a little experience in another organization before you join your own family business. But the way it turned out, I joined as a trainee. And then sort of worked my way for 2 years in India. Then my parents felt it would be a good idea to send us to the UK and try and turn around a business that was not doing well. And that would be really throwing us into the deep end and helping us to succeed. So we went through that.
When you say we, it's you and your
brother? Me and my husband, yeah.
Sure.
Firoz had also joined Thermax before we went to the UK. And again, working in an environment which is entirely new, figuring out which products sell in that market. I mean, it was a very, managing a company that had no negative cash flows, literally scrounging, weren't able to fly had to drive to Germany to paint our boilers ourselves. Mm. I mean, it was a very, very difficult 4 years. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was one of the best experiences of our lives, both personally and professionally. And then, of course, coming back, unfortunately, when my father passed away. And then I was put onto the board of the company. So circumstances made me get onto the board. And then, of course, a year later, my brother passed away. Mm. And then I was looking after certain businesses. I also got into finance because I said I must learn how to do finance. So I think the whole journey has been to try and see how to expose us to different parts of the organization. But I think you are never, ever prepared for when a transition actually happens. Mm. So my mother decided at the age of 62 that she wanted to retire. Now, my mom is a very impulsive person in that she tells the whole world that she's going to do something so that it's a commitment that she can't go back on. Mm-hmm. It's a way for her to keep to her commitment. Mm-hmm. So I heard about her retirement through public sources, which I wasn't very happy about. And of course, the board then wanted me to be take over as chairperson. Mm. And I had many, many doubts, Deepak, to be honest, at that time. I wasn't quite prepared. I honestly thought my mom would stay on till a typical age of 70 or whatever, you know, right. And we've had such a good equation that right. I felt fine. I mean, it's not like she's holding on to a particular position or anything like that. She's always given us a lot of leeway. But so I wasn't ready for it. I didn't particularly want to take on the chairperson. I was a little nervous of how I'm going to perform vis-a-vis my mom and dad who had reached certain heights in whatever they had done. And that's when I decided I'd go to Vipassana. And it is, I find that the just being with myself, just being in my own thoughts for 10 days without talking, without writing, reading, really helped me to think through. And then when I came back, I agreed to take on this role. And in terms of, and mom then stepped back. So was there a hand-holding to see me through? Not really. My mom did it more to help me because she didn't want me to feel that she's decided to retire and yet she's pulling the strings. So in some ways, it was a total pullback.
She was too true to the statement. Yeah.
Totally true. And she said, I'm there for when you need me.
Fair enough.
And also remember that mom had taken over, I mean, she was head of HR. So correct. She had taken over under circumstances when my dad passed away.
Right.
So it's not like my mom had built the business and things like that. It was my father and my grandfather who had done that. So, but the wisdom that I got and that I've always continued to get from mom has been tremendous throughout. It's not been in terms so much on strategy.
Sure.
Not the typical business-related stuff. But I think the wisdom on life, on relationships, on people, that has been just tremendous.
Fascinating. And just building on that, Meher, one of the pieces I'm curious about is how people scale up. I mean, one is about the different points in time where you took on different roles. But again, if you sort of look at your journey, or even Anu Aga's journey, when she was thrust into the role from being an HR head to the head of the company, or even in your case, what have been some of the pillars of how you've grown over time to take on bigger responsibilities?
I think different people have played a different role for me. My mom's played a very crucial role. I think Firoz has played a very crucial role because in the context of taking on and chairing the board, he is my biggest critic. And in both positive as well as giving feedback for improvement. And I feel my board has been very helpful in terms of giving me inputs for feedback and changes. I feel people within the organization also. Luckily, we have a very good team from within who are really committed, who are really here, not so much for themselves, but to make a success of the organization. It's almost like a purpose for which they are in the organization. We're lucky to have that. And therefore, I think different people have played different roles in terms of transitioning for me and for my mom, both.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And for Firoz.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And just picking up on one of the things you said, Meher, which is about you losing your father and brother in quick succession. What's been your approach to dealing with shocks? How do you stay centered, and how do you stay in control? And what have been the lessons from, let's say, those two events, which I'm sure, changed a lot of things for you and your mom?
I'd say over there, you know, with my father, of course it was a shock, but in a way it was a sword hanging over his head because he smoked and he had had a bypass surgery, he had had a stent. And so it was like any time. With my brother, it was, why have you chosen my brother, you know, who's all of 25? And I was very, very angry with God, with the world. And I have to say, I don't know how my mother is such a huge pillar of strength. But she did a lot of reading on death. And she went through Vipassana after Dad died, after Kurush died. And she was really there in terms of saying that you can't ever say, why me? Just look around you. And truly, if we looked around us, you have to say, thank you, God. Mm. You know, the gratitude is far more than, why did you pick me? Or why did you pick our family for this so-called disaster? And she always says that life and death are two sides of the same coin. And it took me a while. And I can't say that I'm still afraid of death. I say more for my loved ones than for myself. But I have really learned a lot in that I feel that the gratitude that and the privileges and whatever that I have are far, far, far more. And another big thing that I've learned from death is that with both my brother and my father, if you had to rewind the clock and say, would you have lived your life differently, knowing that your dad will die at 60 and your brother at 25, would you do anything different? And I'd say predominantly so, not a lot. So the relationship that I had with both was so strong that I don't think I would have changed very much. And therefore, there was no guilt after death. And I find that that really helped in my healing process. And I think the same for Anu. So the biggest learning that I would say, or the biggest takeaway that I would say is try and really cherish the relationships that matter to you while people are alive so that you really don't have that guilt once they are no longer there.
That's a great insight. I guess in a lot of ways it informs how you spend your time today.
Yeah, absolutely.
But on a related note, also tying it back to Vipassana, which clearly has had an impact on you, the other theme that I'm curious about in the context of leadership is mindfulness and thoughtfulness. So talk to us a little bit about how this has helped you, not just that one event per se, but just in general, as you think about making good judgment as a leader, as a chairperson, how is it, how is meditation?
I have to say, Deepak, I meditated beautifully for those 10 days and probably for a couple of months thereafter. After that, it's zero. And in fact, a friend of mine just came over for dinner last night and we said, let's go. We both want to go back to Vipassana again. It's been many years now. It's been 20 years since not 20, 14 years since I went. But that's a long time. So in that sense, it helped me at that point in time.
Understood.
But I am a person who is quite balanced in terms of, I'm not overreactive. I'm not that kind of a person. So I don't know, meditation couldn't have helped because I only did it for a few months.
Fair.
But I think temperamentally wise, it's not something that, so I do sort of think, weigh the pros and cons, and then
Understood.
Take a decision.
And the other piece I try and explore is, clearly you spoke about music being a big chunk. And I was sort of reading this book, Da Vinci, by, it was a biography by Walter Isaacson, which got released, published recently. And he speaks about the need to exercise the left brain and the right brain in equal measure and uses him as an example to make the point. How do you talk to us a little bit about how music is sort of informed, just you as a person, and how it sort of helped you stay sane? Or has it just been a passion that you've been pursuing?
Yeah, I started with the piano
When
I was seven. And along the way came the choir. And I thoroughly enjoy singing. Not individually, but in a group. It's a fantastic group. And I love being with people whom I gel with and think alike, or we have this similar interests. And this is one of them. And I find that choir is almost like a meditation.
Interesting.
In some ways, it's taking you away from the humdrum of life. And our conductor is one who has always believed in explaining to us what the words that we're singing mean. And that has made a big difference in terms of, if you know, if there's a purpose to what you're, to the way you're singing, to what you're singing, the music sounds enormously better than if you're just singing the words.
I hear you.
You know? And I think the same thing is for business. I feel that if you have a purpose for your existence, that drives you multifold than if you're doing it for a top line and a bottom line and a share price. I feel those are, I feel that's an outcome. I don't think we are here to drive a 10,000 crore top line. We are here to conserve resources. We are here to preserve the future. We are here to conserve energy, preserve the environment. You know, so we are here for that purpose. And in doing so, we'll get to the 10,000 crores.
Very interesting.
You know?
So the driving force.
So I think the purpose is really something that that drives in whatever you do. Whether it's your music, or whether it's also in, I think in music, it also in some ways makes you, brings in humility, because you're one amongst 20 people. You're no better, no less. You're one and the same. So in some ways, it brings you down to earth.
Takes the hierarchy away.
Takes and the sort of complete hierarchy away, which I love. And
it also, I guess it also pushes you to be present at that point in time to sing that right note. And sort of listen to what the others are doing.
Somebody. And also in some ways, like an orchestra, each one is responsible for doing their part to make the total complete. If you do not get that part right, you are the weakest link in the chain. So in some ways, again, at the workplace, it's each one who has to pull their weight together to make 2 and 2, 22 and not just 4. You know, so it's really coming together again for that purpose or that cause.
And just on the notion of leading a purposeful organization or a purpose-driven organization, what's been your approach, or what's been the learning in terms of translating that from what Meher feels passionately about to really cascading it down? How have you gone about really getting this purpose to be breathed through the ranks of the organization?
See, luckily for me, I think my father, my grandfather, then my mom, and Feroz and me, all of us have sort of, it's all started with the journey that my grandfather and father started many years ago. I've built on it. And I think the only difference is that I felt very, very strongly about the whole issue of climate change, the whole issue of global warming, trying to move away from fossil fuels as much as we can. Or if we are using fossil fuels, how do we be really the most efficient and use the least for the maximum output? How do we use waste heat and any form of waste, why heat? Any form of waste to produce something of value. So that's what I've been trying to drive within the organization. And as I say, the roots were already there. It's just sort of building more on it. And luckily, Unni has that passion, our MD, and many people at the top. So they've been driving it. Because ultimately, in a non-executive role, it's very difficult for me to drive certain things unless I have alignment at the top.
Correct.
And so to get that alignment at the board level, at the top, is my responsibility. After that, in some ways, to percolate it,
it's left to
the executives. Yeah.
Got it. I want to move to a different theme, Meher, about philanthropy, which is CSR and philanthropy, both of which are close to your heart. First of all, for the purpose of listeners, talk to us a little bit about the distinction between the two, because I think sometimes people use the two interchangeably. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about CSR, the way you think about it, and how it's similar or different from philanthropy.
I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but the way I look at it is philanthropy is more personal. So it's what you do with your money, what you do. So say take myself. It's where do I get the money from? Either I get it from a salary, which I don't receive now, but whatever, salary and my dividend. Now, what do I do with that is my philanthropy. In terms of financial. Of course, time would be the same irrespective. Whereas CSR is corporate social responsibility. So in some ways, it's the money of the corporate. Okay, so that's in terms of financial resources. Corporate social responsibility, of course, goes beyond that in terms of what do you want to do with the company's money in terms of resources to make an impact on society. So we've decided in both philanthropy as well as CSR to look at education. And we are also trying to see how do we make an impact sometimes with similar NGOs, but leveraging on both our personal money as well as the corporate money.
So that you're not diffusing your efforts
So that
across.
You're not diffusing, so that you're then making an impact. Otherwise, it could be a little here, a little there. And I always feel that whether it's philanthropy or whether it's a corporate social responsibility, if you flitter away the money in terms of 10, 15, 20 little causes, you're not possibly going to see that change happening in your lifetime. Of course, depending on the cause that you take. And so I think it's nice to be able to leverage, nice to be able to try and work with other corporates, which is what we're doing in a few of our ventures. It's nice to be able to work with the government, because the government, nobody can bring scale as much as the government. And you can only do so much. You can be like a proof point in terms of what you do. But ultimately, then it's the government that scales it up.
Got it. And a couple of things, right? I think this, if I look at the questions that people often ask, where to give, how to give, and how much to give. Where to give, you said education.
That's for us.
For you.
Yeah.
Right. Any insights around how you got there?
The way we got there is, I mean, purely because when my brother was around, he was very keen on giving a lot of our money. And he sort of told my mom and put a gun to her head and said, you have to give 90% of your wealth away. And my mom said, you can't tell me what I should do with my money. You concentrate on what you are doing. And of course, then he passed away a year later. And so my mom felt that, let's do something, you know, and of course, as I said, she's been a social worker, so she's always done something or the other, but nothing in an impactful manner. And we said, how do we do it? We are so busy with Thermax and we've got so much on our plate. Let's find a good, credible NGO that we trust. We had no idea whether it was going to be education, health, music, science, nothing.
Sure.
We just came across somebody, told mom, why don't you go and meet Shaheen Mistry? At that time, she had just started Akanksha. And so mom met her and their relationship grew and she just felt that this is someone I can trust. And so that's how we started with education. And then we've seen the power of education through Akanksha, through Teach for India, through all the other NGOs that we're working with. And we've seen how it can change a child, a family's life. And it's with that that we decided, let's focus much more and let's focus all our efforts on education and then try and make a difference. So that's how it started. There was game plan or anything like that.
Very interesting. And talking about next generation, Meher, how do you think about continuity, intergenerational continuity versus giving them the liberty to pursue whatever they want to? How does that play out in a context like yours?
I've always believed, and Firoz and I both have partnered each other in believing that our children really should decide what they want to do in terms of what they're genuinely interested in, what they're passionate about, what makes them happy. I don't ever want my children to feel that Thermax is a burden and that they have to take over or any such thing. I feel they need to be responsible owners. They need not be in day-to-day management. If they want to do something else with their life, it's entirely up to them. I don't think it's fair for me to prescribe or for Firoz to prescribe in terms of you shall do engineering so that then you can come and you can join the company and then you can work up the ranks and no. Luckily for us, our son is interested in joining the organization. At the same time, I've shared with him in terms of that I have a regret of not joining somebody else before joining Thermax. So if you feel that that's the right thing to do, I think you might be happy to get inputs elsewhere before you come and join the company. So he's in that stage of thinking it through. He started off with engineering and then moved to economics. Thinking in between that, oh, if I give up engineering, my parents will be really unhappy. And we've honestly stuck to our belief of saying, really do what you enjoy doing. And I would say that my parents said the same thing to Purush and me. They never ever made us feel that you have to join Thermax. Having said that, of course, subtle pressures are always there. And of course, people came in as we were growing up. People would come in from Thermax, come home and sit with my parents, chat, and we would be hovering around. So you're constantly hearing, I would go to the factory at some stage on a Saturday.
There's a term coined by the Richard Thaler, who won the Nobel Prize this time, libertarian paternalism.
Yes.
Which is, it seems like you're giving the choices, like, but correct. There is a strong back.
I think that's very true.
Undercurrent of paternalism in the background, which the kids don't see.
Which you don't realize. And so I think my daughter is doing music. She's doing music technology. So I really feel that I want them to do, but whatever they do, put in your best.
Got it.
That's really important to us. And that's always been very important to my parents as well. So,
just changing track, Meher, one of the other themes I wanted to talk to you about was women leaders at the top. And again, you're passionate about education as well in a lot of ways. And as you look at the pipeline of, let's say, women leaders from, let's say, the schooling or the education system, right, to the boardroom, clearly it's a leaky pipeline. I think that's that topic has been well discussed. But what's your point? What's your view on the key points of leakage where one could look at and how we could think about it? Where, you know, I guess the question is, are there two or three things where there isn't as much commentary as there should be?
Right.
For us to have more women leaders at the top?
I think women, I mean, first of all, I feel that if you were to really look at our education system, I mean, look at Pune itself, there are 230, I think, municipal schools in Pune municipal limits, which go up to the 7th standard. And there are 52 that go up to the 10th. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about municipal.
Mm.
So automatically, a child's education stops in the 7th standard. Unless the parents value education and want to put a child through a private school and pay for it. Not that a private school is necessarily better or anything like that.
But there's an economic hurdle.
There's an economic hurdle. Mm. If you have an economic hurdle, many times they'd put a boy through, tell the girl, it's okay. You know, you can do something else. After all, you're going to just get married. So I think it starts with the education system. And I'm not talking about private schools, I'm only talking about municipal. But I tell you the kind of potential that we have in our system with the poor in terms of tremendous thinking ability, vision, wanting to do things is huge. If only we can give them the opportunity. So I think a lot of it lies in our education itself, you know. Another thing is in terms of toilets. Mm. If you don't have toilets when a girl reaches adolescence, how do you expect her to go to school?
Mm.
You know, so I think some of these things, and this is now pan-India I'm talking, sure. It has to really be thought through for us to see more and more women. Because unless the supply increases, you'll have less and less at the top.
Correct.
Then, of course, you come into industry and I think women go through different phases in their life. So, initially, they're all gung-ho coming to work. Then, of course, they need to take a break.
As a maternity context.
When they have their children. How open is the organization to helping a woman cope with that phase? How open is the organization in terms of giving flexi time to the woman after she has the child and as the child is growing up? And I think flexi time and all these, I think, are not to be given just to women. That also I believe. I believe if an organization does it, it should be absolutely to both. Yeah. There's no difference. And I think a dad plays as important a role in bringing up children as a mother does. So, especially in today's, you know, in this new age.
Sure.
I feel that an organization very often should have a responsibility to help these various phases to be seen through. And I don't think we do enough of it. I also feel that having role models very often at the top in the organization of women can help being a mentor to women down the line, you know, so that then they can see that, okay, if I do this, I can get up there as well.
If she can, why can't I?
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think a few things that organizations really need to do, and it's not easy.
Hmm.
It's not easy, but I'd love to see it happening more and more, starting with our own company. Where the percentage is very, very low.
Right.
And then, of course, we're always told that it's an engineering company.
We
don't have women coming through the pipeline.
Hmm.
But there are others who've done it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think you only have to look at some other role model or benchmark to see how can we improve.
Just a final question, Meher. You spoke about potential in the context of kids in some of these schools. Again, the title of this podcast is Play to Potential. And there are two pieces to this when I think about it. One is, you know, just like businesses ask two questions in the context of the strategy, which is where to play and how to win. I feel leaders ask two questions as they go through the journey, where to go and how to grow. In summary, any headline themes on how people could play to their unique potential?
I think you can play to your unique potential if you have a passion in whatever you do. And very often you don't even realize possibly what your passion is. I do realize that. So then even if you don't have your passion, I would say in terms of the commitments you make to yourself, if you were to make a commitment to yourself that I should not have more than one coffee a day, or I should do my 1 hour of exercise or my 1 hour of meditation every other day. If you stick to those commitments, I think you feel good about yourself and you're willing to take on the next and you're willing to take on the next. And that's how you grow as an individual. And I also feel that as a leader, I think the most important thing is to be self-aware and lead yourself before you can lead others. So getting in touch with who you really are, I think matters over time. I don't know if I've answered it.
I think
sometimes I speak of passion because I do have certain passions, but I do see many, many people who say, I don't have that passion right now, you know, so then what? And then I'm saying, have confidence in yourself and be committed to whatever you commit to. And somehow something will click somewhere.
And it goes back to the one of the phrases you use, self-awareness, right? It's sort of also not just doing, but also reflecting on the doing. Over time,
something comes up, yeah.
But lovely. Thanks so much for your time, Meher. A pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
I hope you found this conversation purposeful. For visiting some of the older conversations, you could visit playtopotential.com. If you're new to the podcast and want to quickly catch up on the key takeaways from 2017, you'd look up at the previous podcast upload, or you could go to YouTube and type Play to Potential, one word, and highlights from 2017. Instead of listening by speaker, if you want to listen to content around a specific theme, you could visit the curated playlist tab on the website, which has content across multiple speakers but along a certain theme. Finally, if you wish to get a written-up synthesis of the nuggets in this conversation, do visit the Contact Us page on the website and share your coordinates with us. Rest assured, we do not use the emails we collect for any marketing usage or for sharing with any other party. Thank you, and look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.